Welcome. It's great to have you all here today. We have a really very popular guest, one who's fortunately been at CSIS before. I was just talking with Tezzy Schaefer, and she said that she discovered him before. But we hosted him when the rest of the world brought him the fame that his book Taliban so rightly generated. But anyway, I'm Rick Barden. I'm the co-director of the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project here at CSIS. On behalf of my co-director, Karen Von Hippel, John Hamry, our president, Tezzy Schaefer, Ambassador Tezzy Schaefer, and the others who've worked on these issues, it's a great pleasure to have all of you here today. Thank you for joining us. I think it's going to be a wonderful, lively hour and a half for anybody who has spent time with Ahmed Rashid. This will be among your more enjoyable events of the week. It's been especially generous of our esteemed colleague, Alex Thier, at USIP to invite us to co-host with USIP this event. We're really pleased always to work with Alex. He's done some wonderful work on Afghanistan and on Pakistan, and he will do the more formal introduction of our guest, and then we'll be part of a conversation which we will then expand to include your questions and a conversation with everybody in the room. Alex.
Thanks, Rick. It's really a great pleasure to see so many people. We were a little bit astounded by the turnout, but Rick and I are painfully aware that it doesn't have to do with our names on the invitation, so we'll make our interjections brief. And thanks, Rick. The work of Rick's Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project, I think, has been leading thought for a lot of us on the issues that Ahmed's book really deals with in a broader sense, and so it's a pleasure to do this together with you. But it's really my great honor and pleasure to invite Ahmed back to Washington to talk to us about what he's doing. The reason that you're here is because you know Ahmed, and so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on introduction, because his name is truly among few journalists and observers in the world known pretty much around the world for the remarkable work that he's done. And I want to say something about that work, because I first met Ahmed in Kabul in 1995, in the height of the Civil War. And at the time, amongst the group of people who were looking and thinking about Afghanistan, Ahmed was the old-timer. And that was in 1995. He has been literally risking his life for the last 30 years to bring what is, if not the best, certainly among the best reportage that has come out of the region, as Ahmed calls it in his book, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Central Asia, bringing knowledge to the rest of the world about what's happening in that critical region, often toiling in some obscurity, but since 9/11, unfortunately, probably toiling without enough obscurity, because people have been paying such intensive attention. I think one of the reasons that we listen to Ahmed is because he doesn't bring a Pakistani perspective to his reporting. He doesn't bring an Asian perspective or Islamic perspective or in the other places that he's studied. Ahmed truly brings a human perspective to the work that he does. And therefore, he has in many ways transcended, I think, the confines of region or nationality to be able to speak to all of us in the world about what's going on there. And related to that, and this comes through so strongly in the book, that because of that, it always allows him to be honest and forthright and courageous in his reporting. Many people, I think, around the world, but particularly in the region, who get access to the powerful sometimes succumb to their charms. And Ahmed has had access to all of the great and good of Afghanistan and Pakistan and the region for 30 years, and he never ceases to say exactly what he thinks, which is also usually the truth about these people. And it's critically important for us to understand all of that. I want to just say one word about the book itself before turning to Ahmed. The book, Ahmed's book that just came out this week, Descent into Chaos, is for sale out in the back, and Ahmed will stay after to sign copies of the book. But it's really the first comprehensive book on post-9/11 experience in that region. And it is a brutally honest book and one that is critical reading for all of us to understand where things can or might go from here. One thing in particular that I want to highlight importance to that Ahmed spends a lot of time on because I think it's so fundamentally important is what I refer to as the original sin of the intervention in the country, which is essentially our strategy of outsourcing the critical work that was to be done to warlords and generals and people who were unlikely to carry forward the incredible burden that we all bore coming out of September 11th and certainly really coming out of the Soviet invasion and the aftermath there. Finally, I just want to give a warning, which is not to read this book in bed. not only because it's heavy and you might hurt yourself, but having spent the last couple nights in bed trying to get through the book, it will give you nightmares. Because this book really, I think, serves as something of an intellectual bludgeon for all of us to wake up and understand not only what has happened, which is critically important, but to understand really where things are going. And so with that, I turn it over to Ahmed to tell us what happened in greater detail and where things are going. So it's my pleasure to welcome Ahmed Rashid.
Thank you. Thank you. God, Alex, I mean, if you give everyone an introduction like this, I mean, for heaven's sake, I had tears in my eyes. I didn't know what to do. I mean, you know, it's the sweetest words anyone has ever said to me, and I'm very, very grateful to you for saying these things. And thank you so much for all of you to come. I read the list. I think half the State Department is here, so I better be careful about what I say about the State Department and Richard Boucher, you know. I see that AID and, you know, and the Defense Department, a lot of, but I see a lot of friends also, which is very lovely. Well, you know, I'll spend as much time as I can on answering your questions. So I'm not going to go into great detail about this book, but one of the theses about the book, which is, you know, a cliche now, is that, of course, Iraq was a huge distraction for Afghanistan. But I say very, very sincerely that Iraq remains for me still a sideshow compared to what is happening in Pakistan and Afghanistan. Iraq, with the next administration, will eventually be settled after you put together a regional alliance of the neighboring Arab countries of Iraq, which must include Iran, which means that the U.S. will have to talk to Iran to do that. Iraq will remain a Middle East problem. It will be unstable. It will be unsafe. U.S. troops will probably have to remain to some extent, but it will remain a Middle East problem. Most critical of all, despite all the hype and all the hoopla and all the information from the intelligence agencies, there, as far as I know, there has been no terrorist strike from al-Qaeda in Iraq anywhere else in the world. Iraq is not a center for global terrorism. It is not a center for global jihad. And that point, I think, is what I say in my book. Why this region is important is that rather than after 9/11 and the attack on Afghanistan, rather than lowering the temperature, the actions of this administration, and which has led to a lot of inaction in the region by the leaders in the region, has unfortunately led to a far bigger crisis we face today. I won't say that than we faced in 9/11, but we are facing a far bigger crisis than any of us expected. And this is particularly due, you know, in Pakistan and Afghanistan. Now, I just want to touch very briefly, I mean, on four or five points that I said, you know, that I make here, that the U.S. had going for it right after 9/11, which was utterly squandered by the Bush administration. Number one, you had the whole world with you, and you rejected the world. You said, we're going to do Afghanistan alone. You threw NATO out. You didn't want NATO involvement. You didn't want you wanted an alliance of the willing, so-called, rather than a, and that of course then affected when you wanted to do Iraq. The Europeans were very miffed by what had happened, and they didn't want to join you. Certainly, one of the reasons they didn't want to join you in Iraq was because of the handling that they received at the hands of Donald Rumsfeld and Paul Wolfowitz during the initial days after the invasion. You formed a very effective regional alliance to fight the war, which included Pakistan and India, Central Asia and Iran, and you dispersed that alliance within months of winning the war. India and Pakistan almost went to war a few months later. You were talking to the Iranians about stabilizing Afghanistan, but within a few weeks, Iran was termed the Great Satan. You completely dispensed with that. And that alliance today is the competition in Afghanistan between these same neighboring countries. Much of what we saw during the Civil War is one of the driving factors for the continued instability in Afghanistan. That regional alliance was vital to have been, that should have been kept in place, and it wasn't. The third massive plus you had, which was a historical shift from Afghan history, as you know, we know it, that the Afghan people had welcomed you. 90%, I think, of the Afghan people welcomed the removal of the Taliban regime, and they were willing to tolerate the presence of American and foreign troops. And you squandered that because you weren't interested in what the Afghans were expecting, which was reconstruction and development. Instead, within months of winning the war, the Americans shifted the whole focus to Iraq, Afghanistan was put on freeze, if you like, on hold. I call it on hold. And that means the orders from Washington were to the ambassador, to the commander of U.S. forces, you know, just don't create any problems. Just hold everything there. Just, you know, let everything freeze. Don't let the central government get too active. And the key to holding Afghanistan was, as Alex says, empowering the warlords. There was a deliberate, it wasn't a proxy, it was a deliberate. They were on the CIA payroll for the next 2.5-3 years. And empowering the warlords was defined in the Defense Department as being, these warlords will keep the peace in the countryside, and these warlords will help us hunt Al-Qaeda. Well, the warlords, half the warlords were in bed with Al-Qaeda, and they were taking money from Al-Qaeda. So they were of no asset whatsoever. And secondly, the warlord history in Afghanistan was not that they would keep the peace, but they would break the peace, and that they would create more problems, as they did for the central government. And the continuously for you know, until 2004, really, Karzai and the government are just faced with balancing off, you know, one warlord or another, because the Americans will not take any action against the warlords. Now, let me just touch on the three or four similar points on Pakistan. The Taliban, first of all, were not defeated; they were routed. Many of them were killed, but many of them escaped, and they escaped to Pakistan. And the moment they did so, the U.S. lost all interest in the Taliban. So consequently, the Taliban were allowed to regroup in Pakistan. They were allowed to set up their offices and bases. And by 2003, they were back fighting inside Afghanistan. This was the policy dictated to, the policy with Musharraf was help us find Al-Qaeda. There's a single agenda, single item agenda for Pakistan, which was help us get Al-Qaeda. And you, Musharraf, can do what you like domestically. You can do what you like with the Taliban. We're really not interested. And this policy really went on almost without stop until perhaps last year, when I think people in Washington finally woke up to the fact that Pakistan was really now facing a huge domestic political crisis, as well as a crisis of terrorism and extremism, given that all the terrorist groups' leadership was now centered. Were now headquartered on the Pakistan side of the border, not on the Afghan side of the border. So ignoring the Taliban role in Pakistan was, I think, hugely detrimental to Pakistan's interests and ultimately to U.S. interests. Of course, alongside this was the huge mistake of allowing Musharraf to set up a rigged political system in 2002. He wanted to perpetuate himself. He saw I called this 2002 election that was held and the referendum that was held that made him president a huge missed opportunity. Because I think if the army had been even remotely sensible, and if there had been a little bit of pressure from the Defense Department at that time, I think the army would have understood that a rigged system, a rigged domestic political system, is not going to last very long. It's just not sustainable. So very briefly then, you know, we come to the present situation. I think the present situation is extremely dire, simply because we've had a free and fair election. We have a civilian government that has done the best possible job, in my opinion, of trying to form a coalition government of all the political parties, except for the fundamentalist parties and the party that backed Musharraf. Now, on paper, this coalition government looks like the best chance that we've had. Unfortunately, it has been bogged down in all sorts of, you know, interscene problems, which I won't go into. But essentially, I think in the long term, I'm still hopeful, simply because I think every time we have come out of military rule, and this was an 8-year, 9-year stint of military rule, we've had these political crises. I mean, you must understand what the military do to a country when they start ruling the country. They destroy institutions. They undermine, you know, the bureaucracy, the police. They politicize everything in favor of the army. They send all the politicians into exile or into jail, as is what happened this time. I mean, they don't allow a new generation of politicians to come up. So unfortunately, we're still dealing with the same politicians that we had 20 years ago, simply because we've been, you know, having these bouts of military rule. And exactly the same thing has happened in Zia's time, in Ayub's time. It's going to take some time before this coalition government settles down. I hope the army is patient. I hope the army does not move towards trying to take power again, given that there is going to be several months of mayhem and confusion, and there's a very severe economic crisis. But this is the moment when I think the international community should be supporting the civilian government. Economically, I was incredibly impressed with Joe Biden when he called for this democracy dividend for Pakistan, which I think is very well deserved and really needs to be given. I hope that the... but, of course, during this critical period, the world really doesn't... or the U.S., you don't have the time and patience to watch this civilian government mature day by day, because you're faced with this direct threat of terrorism and extremism, which is now very heavily based in Pakistan. We now have the additional problem of the Pakistani Taliban, which are... a homegrown phenomenon, but a very much a result of the lackadaisical attitude of the U.S. after the war. The fact was that, you know, the Pashtun tribesmen who bought across the Arabs and the Afghan Taliban from Tora Bora and from the war in Afghanistan, these guys, you know, they were mule drivers. Baitullah Masood, the leader of the Pakistani, he had 2 mules when he started out, and he carried the first Arabs across. He then bought 2 pickups. And he then bought 50 pickups because of the money he was making. And then he got a bodyguard, and then he got a militia. And this is the natural progression that happens, you know, in the tribal areas, simply. He is now a de facto commander of several Taliban, Pakistani Taliban groups. But the army, I think, is... if you've seen my piece today in the Washington Post, I mean, the army is simply, I think, chickening out of taking real responsibility for dealing with this threat of extremism. And I think it's a very dangerous and very high-risk policy that the army is playing. And unfortunately, it has lumped this with the it has lumped this whole policy onto the civilian government. The civilian government did not take these decisions. These decisions were taken even before the elections. The military was in dialogue with people like with the Pakistani Taliban well before the elections. And these deals have come to fruition now. And essentially, the army is saying, well, now you're the prime minister, you're the civilian government, you take responsibility for this. And it's not something, it's being very seriously questioned in private, but in public, because of their own problems, they're not able to, you know, they're having to go along with what the military is basically selling them. Lastly, I just want to touch on your own election. I think it is of huge importance to this part of the world. I hope that the next administration is going to very seriously sit down and strategize about what to do. And there are just 2 very simple suggestions. The first is that this region has now become intensely interlocked. You cannot have an Afghanistan policy without having a Pakistan policy. You cannot have a Pakistan policy without having a linking it to India. And the same goes for Iran and, you know, Central Asia and all the rest of it. We need a strategy to look at this region differently and in a more positive light. And in order to be able to resolve some of the problems in this region, we need to connect them to other countries and to be able to draw this together. That's not saying you don't need a country-by-country policy, but you need an overarching strategy. And this is precisely what this administration has utterly, utterly failed to do. And it has driven us into this corner right now where we are not able to concentrate on building democracy in Pakistan or stabilizing Afghanistan. But we are still, 7 years down the road, having to cope with more terrorism, more extremism, etc. I think I'll end here. Thanks a lot.
Great, thank you. Well, Alex spoke of your brutal honesty, and at one point in your book you write that visiting Washington during President Bush's first term was an Orwellian experience, an unreal world of uncritical, gullible complacency on the part of the public and the institutions that are supposed to check the president. That's all of us. You're here now at a different time. You've just expressed your hopefulness for that, maybe a break from this pattern. Are you seeing the level of interest and engagement from the United States that is necessary for us to do a serious job on this kind of a problem going forward on this visit or on your more recent visits?
Well, I mean, the short answer is probably no. I mean, I think, you know, on the one hand, the administration, there's a panic reaction to what is happening in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And they're desperate to try and get, you know, something moving so that these two countries don't sink down the plug hole while McCain is running for president. I think there's obviously a huge obsession with Iraq, and I can fully understand that, and I appreciate that. But I think at the same time there's really enormous concern in the administration, but outside the administration I don't think there is that kind of focus on Afghanistan and Pakistan. I think, you know, what Obama has said, you know, about the region, clearly he would want to focus much more on the region. But what has not happened so far is he hasn't put meat on those few comments that he's made. Perhaps it's too early, but we would really like to see some meat put on those comments as to how the Democratic contender is going to deal with this part of the world. Clearly, he wants to put more effort into Afghanistan. He wants to deal with Pakistan at a higher level than the Bush administration has dealt with it. But how he exactly does that, we really don't know.
You've described the relationship between our countries as being fundamentally dishonest and certainly immature and not regionally developed. You say that from the Pakistani view, at least the military of Pakistan, that they approach us on a first say yes and later say but basis. What can we do to break this cycle? I mean, here we are. There's an opening that you've described in Pakistan. It has it's fragile. And yet many of us look at these kinds of openings and we say if this sort of thing had happened in the former Soviet Union, we would have been all over it as a great opportunity for U.S. initiative. What's it going to take? I mean, how do we get a more honest relationship where we actually speak truthfully to each other?
Well, I think the fundamental flaw right from the beginning was dealing only with the military, and even then dealing only with one man, which was Musharraf. Finally, U.S. effort last year, which brought about this kind of coming together of Bhutto, Benazir Bhutto, and Musharraf, a deal that was basically brokered by the U.S. That deal should have been brokered 3 years earlier, simply. I think there has to be, you know, much greater interplay with the civilian government in Pakistan. The fact is that I think the military is very confident that it can run rings around the Americans. It can take American money, but not could fulfill what America's agenda can do. It can take American weapons, but there are no conditions placed by the American military or by the State Department on that aid and on that money that is going to the military. 80%, you know, your own work has shown, 80% of the aid or something it has gone directly to the military. But where are the conditionalities for that aid that has gone to the military? I mean, right now you want to train the Frontier Corps. The Frontier Corps, as we all know, is one of it's a paramilitary force in Pakistan. It's one of the strongest jihadi forces in Pakistan. The Frontier Corps fought with the Mujahideen in the 80s. It fought with the Taliban in the 90s. It's been training the Taliban since then. And you want to give tanks and helicopters to the Frontier Corps without any conditions. So, I mean, I think, you know, what is needed is a much better understanding of the history of this relationship and a much better understanding also of the role of civilian parties. I still hope that, my big hope is that policy in Pakistan is ultimately going to shift away from the military, the control of foreign policy, but that can only be done when the civilian government slowly is empowered, it gets stronger, and it is able to take on the army on these critical issues like relations with India, relations with Afghanistan. And it is in the civilian interest, above all, to have a much improved relationship with India, a much improved relationship with Afghanistan. And it is not in the civilian interest to have groups of extremists running around the country taking territory. So I think, you know, again, there has to be a greater focus on the civilian government.
How about overcoming this persistent ignorance that you described that we have? And actually, it was on our recent visit to Pakistan, it was reinforced in many of our conversations as well. Many of the Pakistani leaders we talked to would speak about the northwest of their country and quote British writings of 60 and 70 years ago, would talk about the Pashtun in almost mythological ways that suggested they didn't really have very good personal knowledge of their own. How do we overcome that? How do we get to the point where we understand the inside tribal feuds and we don't call for drone attacks on houses or on attacks on convoys that are going to that are surrounding President Karzai on the way to his inauguration or whatever it happens to be? How do we overcome these huge blind spots that we have, that we seem to have in just our basic understanding of the place?
Well, you know, first of all, I agree with you that, I mean, you know, I think there's enormous ignorance in Pakistan about the tribal areas. And I think that ignorance has been deliberately perpetrated by the military regime. It served Musharraf's interest for people to remain uninformed about Fatah and what was going on in the Northwest Frontier Province and in the tribal areas. And to develop these myths, this is America's war, we are fighting it very reluctantly. All Taliban are Pashtun, and Pashtun culture reflects Taliban culture, another totally false assumption. Not all Pashtuns are Taliban, and the Taliban certainly don't reflect Pashtun culture. So a lot of this has been run by the media. It has been run by uninformed comment in Pakistan. And it has made a solution to this whole extremism problem in Pakistan much, much more difficult. Because on the one hand, you have people really scared now of Talibanization, the Talibanization that's happening in the frontier and that is creeping down into the cities now. I mean, I was in Peshawar about 10 days ago, and honestly, the situation in Peshawar is far worse than in Kabul. You have four militias outside Peshawar now, within 10 miles of Peshawar, who are Talibanizing the villages around Peshawar. And people in Peshawar are openly discussing whether the Taliban are going to enter the city in 3 months or whether they're going to enter the city in 6 months. Now, you know, nobody in Kabul is quite discussing that yet, whether the Taliban are sitting, 10 miles from Kabul and they're about to enter the city. So so people are very, very fearful about this extremism. But at the same time, they have also been imbibed with, over the last 7 years, with the fact that they don't want an American solution. They don't want anything, they don't know how to resolve this issue, either at a political level or at a military level. And there's an enormous amount of misinformation that is going on there. I think here, frankly, as far as the misinformation here is concerned, I think we've seen how this administration has manipulated the media over the Iraq war. I think a lot of very similar manipulation has happened during during recent events in Afghanistan and events in Pakistan. I think the myth that, you know, every time Musharraf arrives here, you know, and the President Bush says, I looked into his eyes and I knew he was telling the truth, you know, and that this deal, after all, when we did the 2006 deal, Musharraf arrived at the White House and it was vouchsafed by Bush, who said, I looked into his eyes and I knew that this deal will work, that this deal with the tribals will work. So I think there's been enormous misinformation here too. And we have to understand this region better. Both Pakistanis and Afghans have to understand their own problems much better. I hope this book is going to be something of an eye-opener to my own people. I hope this book is going to be read by the Pakistan Army. It probably will be, and they probably won't like a lot of what I have to say, but I think, you know, I hope that this kind of educative process happens. It needs to happen in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Let me pick up on this question of the deals. You've spent a lot of time thinking about the Taliban in your career. And one of the things that Ambassador Lakhdar Brahimi has come out recently and started to talk about his reflections of Bonn is that he feels as though he missed an opportunity to try and bring some of the Taliban political leadership into negotiations and discussions about the future of Afghanistan. We now have come to a situation in some ways instigated more by Pakistan than by Afghanistan, but also happening in a less coherent fashion on the Afghan side, of starts of discussions about negotiations with Taliban. And so the question is there a political solution with the Taliban or part of the Taliban? And what could you imagine that looking like?
Look, everyone is talking to the Taliban right now. The Americans, Karzai, the British, NATO, the Red Cross, the UN. I mean, you know, everybody's talking to the Taliban, you know. As to exactly with what aim, I mean, I really don't know. But I think I have a very simple formula here. There is no way that you can negotiate with the Taliban unless you first deal with the sanctuaries in Pakistan. As long as those sanctuaries are there, the Taliban are not going to take negotiations seriously at all. Because for two reasons. One, they don't need to because, you know, they can always retreat back to their side. Secondly, their families are there. And in a sense that they're being held hostage. I recount in the book several instances when the Pakistani authorities have actually held hostage Taliban families of Taliban commanders. Now, as long as these sanctuaries are there, and as long as that recruitment base is there, don't forget there are about three times more Pashtuns in Pakistan than there are in Afghanistan. So this is an infinite recruiting base. You know, not to speak of the fact that now we are getting reports of large numbers of Punjabis and Sindhis and other people fighting in Afghanistan also, you know, from other ethnic groups. So if that, I think, is, you know, I don't think this administration has the capacity to look at the issue the way that I'm spelling it out. I hope the next administration is going to do that. I think, you know, a dialogue with the Taliban, you know, a dialogue with any guerrilla force takes place only when the guerrilla force is losing, not winning, or not perceived to be winning. And secondly, when that guerrilla force is deprived of its sanctuary for recruitment, for weapons, for ammunition, for food, for money, and for everything else. I think that is one of the fundamental mistakes that the U.S. administration made throughout this whole period, that they never looked. And you know, the Afghans were warning them. I mean, Karzai would come here and he would tell Bush, look, my threat is not Al-Qaeda. Osama is not going to overthrow my government and destabilize Afghanistan. My threat is the Taliban. What are you doing about the Taliban? When NATO goes into Afghanistan in 2004, all the NATO foreign ministers and defense ministers and intelligence chiefs, they arrive here and meet Condi and they meet Rumsfeld, and they all are told, you know, And they all express enormous enormous fears that, look, we are going into Afghanistan. We have these very sensitive publics. We're going into southern Afghanistan. You know, we have to fight there against the Taliban. And we're worried about this cross-border movement from Pakistan. And this administration tells the NATO ministers, and I had this firsthand, tells these NATO ministers, don't worry, we'll handle Pakistan. Don't worry, We'll handle Musharraf. We'll cool it all down. We'll make sure that there's no cross-border stuff. And of course, nothing happens. Nobody handles Musharraf. Nobody handles these sanctuaries. So until these sanctuaries end, you know, quite frankly, I mean, a lot of flack has hit NATO for being, you know, weak-kneed. But if you look back, I mean, if you talk to some of these senior officials, they say this: the Americans lied to us. They lied to us that they will deal with the sanctuaries, and they never dealt with them. And that, you know, that feeling, I mean, if you're a government in Europe and you've been lied to and you've sent your troops across and your troops then start getting killed because nothing has been done about these sanctuaries, you know, you get pretty upset. And so you can understand why some of these NATO countries are not willing to trust this administration anymore. I think that's one of the problems, you know, Gates has had in trying to get more troops from NATO, etc. I think everybody in Europe is sitting out until the next administration comes in.
Are you at all hopeful about the Pashtun nationalists having a governance role and doing some of the negotiating, the ANP-led negotiations in the NWFP area? Does that seem a promising opportunity to you? And maybe on the other side of the border, do you see any of these recent military efforts by the Marines in particular to be are we revisiting the rout as opposed to a defeat, or is it going to be inflicting some of the pain that you think is necessary to lead to fruitful negotiations?
The ANP victory, the ANP is a secular Pashtun party which believes in nonviolence, if you can, you know, believe it. It was part of the Gandhiist movement against the British in India. It has a very long history. It has extremely good links with all the Pashtun tribes, etc. And it believes that it reflects Pashtun culture and society and tradition, and it is a complete polar opposite of the Taliban. Now, it's been a very positive thing that they've come in. But I was in Peshawar and met all the senior ANP leaders, and the problem is that all these deals are being done by the army above their head. They are not being informed. The army is not sharing intelligence. It's not sharing information. It's not sharing any kind of decision-making with them, although these are the guys on the ground now in the Northwest Frontier, and these are the guys who the international community would find very easy to work with. You know. So, unfortunately, I mean, first of all, there's this complete lack of, you know, separation between the military and the political leadership. They're not sharing. Secondly, of course, the provincial government in the Northwest Frontier Province only rules what we call the settled areas. They don't rule FATA, which is the seven tribal agencies. FATA is governed directly by the president and the governor. The ANP is calling for political reform in FATA, to bring FATA into the NWFP, make it part of the, you know, bring it into the Pakistan constitution, and do away with the special relationship that FATA has traditionally held with the president. I think that needs to be done, that needs to be done on a very urgent basis. Even if it can't be done right now because the Taliban are occupying the whole of FATA, it needs to be announced and proclaimed and told to everyone in Pakistan that this is the ultimate aim. I think on the other side, again, I mean, you know, this U.S. surge, I mean, is all very well. But it's a political problem of these sanctuaries. The fact is that I don't know if you've been reading these 3,000 Marines went into Helmand and they did a, you know, cleared a lot of area. The Taliban ran back into Pakistan and they will come back again in, you know, once the Marines leave, which will be in a few months' time. So I mean, you know, again, the issue is not of a surge. The issue is of what is, you know, you have to look at guerrilla war as a strategic issue. There's been a lot of success of the U.S. military in eastern Afghanistan, where there have been the counterinsurgency manual is being kind of become operational. They're doing more people to people. They're kicking down less doors. They're not bombing the civilians. It's been very effective. But I met with a bunch of commanders, you know, from there in Kabul, and my only question was, well, very good. I mean, you're doing this in Khost, you're doing this in Jalalabad, you're trying to win over the tribe. The question is, how do you then connect your successes there to building up governance in Afghanistan And secondly, dealing with the wider issue of the Taliban. Winning over one area does not mean that you have a strategy to defeat the Taliban or to strengthen the government, because frankly at the moment there is no U.S. strategy to do that. So you can have these military, isolated military successes in peacekeeping, in winning the locals, in beating back the Taliban, but the whole question is how do you link that strategically to the region, to stabilizing Afghanistan and stabilizing Pakistan? And the missing link is that strategy at the moment, which is what I talked about earlier, but I hope that the new administration tackles that issue.
Well, good. Maybe we can move to your questions. And if you would just do a couple of things. We'll start with individual questions. My suspicion is that we're going to get an overflow, and then we'll go probably to groups of four or five at the same time. But just identify yourself, if you would, please. For those of you who have friends who couldn't make it or want to see this again, Ian will have this on the CSIS website. And perhaps the USIP website as well, since you're the co-host. We're more than happy, obviously, to share it with you. But that should be on within about 24 hours or so. And again, just please say your name when you stand up. We'll get a microphone to you, I think. I think, Tezi, we give you the honor of the first question, if you would. Yes, it was on. Yeah, it was. We could hear you.
Since I claim credit for turning Taliban into a bestseller, I'd like to come
you
back.
And Bin Laden.
I'm Tezi Schaefer, director of the South Asia program here at CSIS. I'd like to come back to two themes that have come up briefly, but I'd like you to connect them a bit, Ahmed. One is sanctuaries, and the other is negotiations. It seems to me, actually, that the U.S. administration is very much in line with your description of the priority of shutting down the sanctuaries. But the government in Pakistan, for reasons that I actually am very sympathetic to, gives its priority to shutting down the militancy inside Pakistan and the suicide bombing that goes with it. There are slightly different but related people involved in both of these. How do you connect? How would you describe the relationship between the Pakistani Taliban and their Afghan counterparts? And how would you, if you were drawing up a strategy, connect shutting down suicide bombing inside Pakistan and sealing off the border, shutting down sanctuaries?
Tezi, I think the strategic decision that the Pakistan Army has to make is to dump the Afghan Taliban. Until we are not prepared to capture, or just arrest and hold the Quetta Shura, the main Taliban leadership, which is called the Quetta Shura, but which is now scattered around Balochistan province. Until we don't do that, we are not going to be able to deal with the Pakistani Taliban or Al Qaeda. I think that is the crux issue. The Pakistani Taliban owe their legitimacy to the fact that they're an appendage of the Afghan Taliban. Now, in the last 2 years, they've even got an agenda of their own, which is we want to conquer the Northwest Frontier Province, we want to Talibanize, the whole of northern Pakistan. But essentially, they were an appendage of the Afghan Taliban. And of course, they were also an appendage to some extent of Al-Qaeda. So I think the key to this, if you look at, do you go for the Al-Qaeda first, do you go for Pakistani Taliban first, or do you go for Afghan Taliban first? The key for me is the Afghan Taliban. Because only then can you can develop a regional strategy which will be of benefit both to Pakistan and for Afghanistan. I don't think you can deal with the Pakistani Taliban in this piecemeal way by having truces and peace agreements with them, but allowing everyone to cross into Afghanistan. Because don't forget, even under these peace agreements, the Pakistani Taliban are still doing their politicization in the north. They're winning over villages or, harassing people and expanding their influence. And all the they may not be bombing, they may not be killing, but they're burning down video shops, they're shutting down girls' schools, they're doing all the usual Taliban stuff. So I think, that's why I said right at the beginning, where the U.S. got its primary priority wrong was to completely underestimate the Afghan Taliban leadership's sanctuary back in 2002 that it received in Pakistan when they retreated into Pakistan. And a key U.S. demand at that time should have been not that only you go after al-Qaeda, but we want the top leaders of the Taliban as well. You know. And then, what Alex said earlier, I think you from that period you could have started negotiating then before the insurgency started. Because there would have been a lot of Taliban at that time who were very demoralized, defeated, killed, etc., who would have been willing to talk, And again, I think, if at that time we had been able to close down this, we had not given refuge to the Taliban, the Afghan Taliban, Afghanistan would be in a much better position.
We are going to have a ton of questions. Why don't we take about three questions in this section, and Alex, you can manage this area over here, and then we'll fight over this one.
Okay.
If you would, please, this gentleman here, and then can you back up a few questions? Are you okay with that?
Sure.
Okay, why don't we do three or four questions together here, because we're just not going to get through everybody.
I'm Stephen Daichi from the Foreign Service Institute. Knowing that there have been a number of initiatives with other issues around the world in this regard, Mr. Rashid, has anyone from the Obama camp approached you for the kind of briefing you're giving here to brief them about this issue?
Just go ahead. Whoever you choose is fine. You've got the microphone.
Pamela Constable from the Washington Post. I'd like to hear your reflections on public opinion in both Pakistan and Afghanistan.
Public what?
Opinion.
All right.
In Pakistan and Afghanistan about the U.S. military role. You were quite critical of the U.S. military, but for example, in Pakistan, there's enormous negative sentiment towards the idea, for example, of foreign troops coming into the Fatah. Mm-hmm. There's enormous outcry that happens whenever there is a bombing, for example, in the Fatah. In Afghanistan, there's been extraordinary public outrage and people being very upset over civilian casualties, even though the numbers have been rather small. The impact has been quite high. There is, I would say, both a growing religiously conservative sentiment in both countries and a growing resentment against what the Western military is doing in both countries. I'd like your thoughts about that. Thank you.
And Pamela, thanks for your writing. If we're ignorant, you can take no credit for our ignorance, because your writing has been terrific. Thank you.
Scott Worden from the U.S. Institute of Peace. I also have a public opinion related question. But more broadly, in the Pashtun areas, both in Pakistan and Afghanistan, you mentioned initially there was 90% approval for the mission in Afghanistan, and that was squandered. I wonder how much of an impact is public opinion in terms of supporting the insurgency and fueling it, and if it is significant, how can that be reversed to get them on board and against the Taliban?
You do one more, or do you want? One more, or do you want? Is that enough?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's start with these. Why don't we start with these? We'll come to you after this.
Well, the Obama question. No, I haven't. Several friends of mine have sent the book to Obama's people, and to Hillary's people also. To say that this is an important book for this American election. But no, I haven't received any response, and. I don't know anyone in the Obama campaign, unfortunately. Paula, I agree with you completely what you're saying. And that, the window of opportunity I talked about, which the Americans had in 2001, 2002, it lasted for a certain period, and then, of course, it dissipated. But I think the other part is, it's not just disillusionment with the Americans or anti-American. It's also massive disillusionment with their own government, both in Pakistan and Afghanistan. There's huge disillusionment with Karzai, and there's, of course, enormous hatred of Musharraf now. So a lot of this kind of anti-American feeling is also a result of being looking inward and increasingly seeing your own leader as being the stooge of the Americans, or fulfilling the American agenda but not fulfilling the Afghan or the Pakistani agenda. So I think, you know, we should keep a balance there. I mean, anti-Americanism per se is perhaps not the correct way to look at it. Anti-Americanism is part of an equal disillusionment with the internal leadership. I think it would be an incredibly stupid mistake if the U.S. was to in any way invade Fatah or to, you know, to send physically to put troops into Fatah. It would be, this is a political and strategic issue which has to be resolved politically and strategically. You know, this is not, you're dealing with an ally here, you're dealing with Pakistan, which has been very much allied to the United States. You're not dealing with a pariah state, or, you know, you're not dealing with the way this administration has treated Iran, for example, where the only option seems to be at any given moment to invade or attack. I think this issue has to be treated as a strategic issue. My whole gripe in this book is that this issue has not been treated as a strategic issue. I think it, you know, and it needs a fresh approach. It needs a new administration to deal with Fatah. The very last thing anybody wants in Pakistan is a invasion of Fatah in any shape or form.
I think we have another microphone
over
here.
Did you promise one person over
go
there?
Ahead. You can honor my promise.
I will keep you honest.
I think this gentleman.
There was one person who you had.
We ripped the microphone out of his hand.
And it was Minister Masoom Stanikzai from Afghanistan. So good pick.
I'm very glad to see you, Rashid, again here. And I'm very also very impressed with the very important points that you have touched upon. My question is that, apart of all these problems, if you look to the issue of negotiation in the past few weeks between the Pakistan government and the Taliban there in Pakistan, and then the different statements that were issued by the different governments. For instance, the British government said that we welcome the negotiation of the Pakistan with the Taliban in Pakistan. The United States government has stated that, yes, and also General McNeil and others also stated that those negotiations increased the attack in the eastern part of Pakistan, and those negotiations should not take place. So what do you think that, how this division of the international community create a psychological environment in around Afghanistan and Pakistan by providing different kind of perception to the people in relation to dealing with Al-Qaeda, Taliban, and others. And all the time, this kind of a division appear in the critical moment when something is happening. And the second part is whether it is not the time that Afghanistan and Pakistan, with a new civilian elected government, supported by the international efforts, to start a joint up effort to negotiate from the both sides, not from one side. Because, as you mentioned, that the Afghanistan problem will not be solved only by Afghanistan and not by Pakistan. Thank you very much. I'm a fellow at the U.S. Institute for Peace, but back in Afghanistan, I was a minister of communication, and now I am an advisor to the president.
And we'll take two more questions from over here in the back, standing at.
Thank you, Alex. Good afternoon, Rick, and good afternoon, Mr. Rashid, Edward Joseph, Johns Hopkins Seitz. Sir, you mentioned the ambivalence of the Pashtun towards the Taliban problem, their fear of the encroaching. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes, the fear of the encroaching Taliban in Peshawar. I was just wondering if you want to say a word about the ambivalence within the military and security establishment and the longstanding relationship with the Taliban. Do you believe that that problem is overrated? Is there no ambivalence within the security establishment itself? And secondly, impending economic crisis, how serious and what impact on civilian rule? Thank you very much.
We'll just take one more in the back. You can pick this young lady here. Lady.
Mariam Sabri from the Hudson Institute. So it seems that you think the military is a big reason for the problems in Pakistan right now, if not the biggest reason. I just wanted to ask you, you talk about this new generation of politicians which could possibly have developed if the military hadn't intervened at the time it did. Do you really think that would have happened, and how exactly? Because it seemed that for that period in between, Bhutto and Sharif were pretty much playing musical chairs. in a sense. And don't you think there's a positive backlash as a result of the military coming in, where you actually see them coming together for a few months and negotiating and possibly, I mean, they talk about they talked about forming a civilian government, a coalition government, although that's falling apart now. And also, I mean, you talk about how the military, the civilian government doesn't really support the decisions the military's made in this war on terror. But do you think any other government would have dealt with this differently, seeing that if the Pakistan People's Party's history is any testament, Bibi helped create the Taliban in a sense. And the other thing I want you to do is, if you could expand on how, it's just very short, on how...
we have 17 questions.
Yeah.
You talk about how there needs to be a change in the traditional relationship between Fatah and the government. What exactly do you mean by that? I mean, what do you envision would be a solution to this, or an alternative to this relationship, in a sense?
Well, let's take these three and we'll keep moving, yeah.
gosh. Look,
let's take these 20.
Yeah.
I agree with you. I mean, I've talked, you know, to, I mean, I met all the, you know, Nawaz Sharif, Asif Zardari, and all the political leaders, and I think there's a real keenness on the political leadership in Pakistan right now to much improve relations with the Karzai government, and to talk to Afghanistan, and to try and resolve these issues. The problem is that the political leadership does not make Afghan policy. That is the problem. I hope that we will reach a time when the political leadership will be strong enough to take initiatives towards Afghanistan, positive initiatives towards Afghanistan, which the military will not be able to defy. But I think the answer to your question is that you have to be a little patient and wait, because I don't see this issue being resolved in a hurry at the moment. And as you know, the military now has even stopped the tripartite commission. I think for 3 months, you know, there was this commission that senior Pakistani, Afghan, and American officers used to meet to discuss border disputes. I think for 3 months they haven't met because the Pakistanis pulled out. And that was a key sort of forum where these differences, etc., could iron out. Now, you know, if you're not even willing to meet at a military tripartite technical level, I mean, what kind of political talks are you going to have? So I think you know, we will get initiatives by the Pakistani political leadership, you know, visits to Kabul, good words, etc., etc. But that is really not, until the power equation in Pakistan changes, that isn't, you know, it's not going to make a difference to Afghanistan. And I think changing that power equation depends a lot on, you know, what the U.S. does. As far as this, you know, I think the morale in the army is very shot through at the moment. The losses they've taken in the tribal areas, the desertions that have taken place from within the military, the refusal of the military to back away from maintaining themselves against India rather than maintaining them, then putting some of their resources into counterinsurgency. And I think, you know, all these issues, I think the other problem with India is the negotiations that the Americans have held with India on India's nuclear program, which is seen by Pakistan, even if it doesn't come through, which it probably won't, but it's seen as a legitimization of India's bomb as opposed to Pakistan's bomb, which is still in the doghouse, as it were, you know. And that has created enormous resentment, I think, in the Pakistan military. The fear, the conspiracy theory, rather, let me say, that somehow, you know, the Indians and the Americans are going to get together to take out Pakistan's nuclear weapons at some stage. Some of these fears are real. Some are paranoid. Some are fueled by vested interests. Some are fueled by the media. Some are fueled by the Army High Command for vested interests. I think all this leaves an army that is really not willing to fight at the moment in the tribal areas. I think the economic situation is extremely dire.
Maybe I wasn't clear. I was talking about ambivalence success because of long-term
ISI.
I think why are we keeping the Afghan Taliban leadership in Pakistan? Because we see the Afghan Afghan Taliban as part of a solution in Afghanistan. We want a pro-Pakistan government in Kabul, or at least the military does. The military wants a pro-Pakistan government in Kabul, and that pro-Pakistan government can only come about when eventually the Taliban are recognized as a political force and go into coalition with Hamid Karzai or with anyone else. I think that is the strategic aim. So I don't think there's much of ambivalence in that aim. If there was ambivalence, we wouldn't be keeping these sanctuaries and the Afghan Taliban there. You know. The economy, I think, is, you know, it remains. I mean, I don't want to go into it. I think it remains a very, very serious problem. And there's a huge flight of capital at the moment. There is a, part of it is linked to the international crisis with fuel prices and food prices. But part of it has been self-inflicted, in a sense, because of the long-running political crisis since February, which has led to a lot of instability. I can't even begin to answer all the questions that you posed. But, you're absolutely right that, you know, the politicians were bickering in the 90s and then they were corrupt and all the rest of it. But, you know, no political government, genuinely elected political government, has seen through a full term in office in Pakistan. And I think you should remember that. I mean, the only government which has been this Shaukat Aziz is the Musharraf government, which, you know, many Pakistanis today don't count as a legitimate government because it came out as a result of a rigged election in 2002. Now, you know, if we had seen, democracy and a democratically elected government being thrown out of office by the voters, I think we would have been in a very different position in Pakistan today. And I think, if the military and other vested interests had given these governments the rope to hang themselves, as it were, they would have hung themselves. They would have been thrown out by the voters. Look at this election. This election, the fundamentalist parties were ruling in the two border provinces of Afghanistan. They've been completely eliminated. And a party that has not been in power since 1970s, 30 years, the ANP has not been in power, really, since the 70s, has come back into power in an overwhelming majority, a secular party. So I think, you know, you have to give, I mean, these are the positive things about Pakistan. These are the positive things about democracy in Pakistan. But, you know, you have to sustain it. And the army has to sustain it also.
We do maybe two more from the section, and we'll move into the middle. So
can you ask?
Yeah, I promise I will come to you. We've only got one microphone in the room, so
I'll recognize your last promise when it gets when it comes to.
Go ahead, that's great. Yeah,
I'm Deepa Olapoli from George Washington University, and I couldn't agree with you more about the appalling lack of understanding about extremism, terrorism in South Asia. And I think part of the confusion, and I wonder if you'd agree with me on this, is that there are sort of two ways that I think people here tend to understand what's going on. And one is to see terrorism or extremism as sort of arising now spontaneously as sort of fragmented cells that are not centrally directed. There's no core that you can go to. And so really they're sort of out of, it's a very difficult foe to identify and fight. What you suggest is a very different kind of situation, which I agree with, and that is that in fact there are actors and states that have given cover, that have given support, but we just don't see that, or we choose not to. And so to me, I think there's an utter confusion that fuels this misunderstanding here, which seems, I'm not sure why it's so difficult to get through, but I'd like your reaction to that. And I guess one more question would be, is this kind of model of our understanding, is it unique to South Asia, or could we say that in fact we can say the same thing about terrorism in the Middle East, or is it that it is in fact more fragmented and harder to pin down and identify in the Middle East, but not so in South Asia?
The gentleman in the front here.
Colonel Dutta, Foreign Policy Association. The considering Pakistan separately cannot be done, as you said, without considering India, India's interests, India and Pakistan interests together. Now, my question is that increasing Talibanization of Pakistan is serving as an impetus to the Jaish-e-Mohammed and other like the militant organization in spreading terrorism in Kashmir. What would be the course that the civilian government now would take to make amends or make amends with the Indian government and the Indo-Pakistan relation?
Then we'll go here for the last third question before we go in the mill.
Thank you. Paolo von Schirach, Schirach Report. You've talked a great deal in many of the questions addressed to this whole point of the Northwest Territories and the sanctuary and the mistakes made by the Americans, all the strategic blunders, etc. However, you have also mentioned that there seemed to be a vested interest, if I understood correctly in answering another question, to keep this Pakistani Taliban alive so that the military would have some tool to in negotiations in the future, political negotiations with Afghanistan. My question then is, given this problem, given the fact that the Pakistani state at this moment, whatever the situation is and how it developed after Musharraf, etc., now with the civilian government, has lost essentially control, jurisdiction on part of its territory, and that you have this ongoing guerrilla insurrection, and that on the other hand you advise against a direct military intervention on the part of the U.S., at the end of the day, how is this practically going to be resolved? In other words, is there a political will within Pakistan to regain sovereignty, which really means in one way or another eliminating or pacifying the Pakistan-based Taliban, including obviously the corollary of the incursions and the continuation of the Taliban insurrection and activities within Afghanistan? That being the problem as you defined it, what are then, and you say it's a strategic issue, then how this strategy is going to be in one way or the other approached? In other words, does Pakistan have at any point the political will, the resilience, the tools in the civilian-military relationship to actually actively destroy this guerrilla force and or destabilize it and or deprive it of its political legitimacy, or what? Because I don't see an end game here. I mean, I see the definition of a problem, but I don't really see the tools that are going to lead us towards a solution. Thank you.
I thoroughly agree with you. I mean, you know, my interpretation still, 7 years on, of Al-Qaeda is not this, that this is some cyberspace and everybody's going through the internet and learning how to make bombs in the internet and all the rest of it. I think I still see Al-Qaeda. I mean, perhaps I'm a bit naive, but I still see Al-Qaeda in similar to what were national liberation movements in the 60s. Al-Qaeda wants to control territory. Al-Qaeda wants to have training camps. Al-Qaeda wants to have access to money and funding. You know, Al-Qaeda wants to be a regular movement with actual control of territory. Now, they lost one territory in Afghanistan, which they had in the 90s. They are trying to regain another set of, you know, they're trying to regain territory now in Pakistan and parts of Afghanistan. And with that comes the whole paraphernalia of, you know, territorial control and what you can do with it. So this is what makes Al-Qaeda in this region, in my opinion, much more dangerous than Al-Qaeda in Iraq or other extremist groups in North Africa or other places, because they cannot control territory there. You know, Al-Qaeda in Iraq has not been able to control territory because the Americans have come in and bombed them or driven them out and they've come back, but there's never been any permanent base camps there. The point is, in Waziristan, these guys have been living there for the last 7 years. I mean, can you imagine? I mean, a child born then is now a seven-year-old child. So, I mean, I think that is, you know, the problem that we are facing. That is why this region is more important than any other region as far as the threat to international security is concerned. Look, when I was talking about India, I was talking about the need to resolve issues to need to resolve the Kashmir issue. The point is, I feel very strongly that India has been sitting on the Kashmir issue since 2004 when the first peace deals were signed between Musharraf and Vajpayee. Now, Pakistan, I think to Musharraf's credit, I mean, one of the things he has done is the army seems to acknowledge that there has to be some solution to Kashmir. And the Pakistanis have dropped most of their very long-standing rigid demands on, you know, UN resolutions, the division of Kashmir, splitting Kashmir, all this kind of thing. And I personally think a solution to the Kashmir problem is very, very reachable, because both countries privately have said that they are willing to accept just a face-saving formula, just a formula that doesn't humiliate the leadership in either country. Nobody now is talking about new borders, new divisions, the Muslims on one side, the Hindus on the other, etc., etc. Everybody's just talking about a nominal kind of solution which would push the issue back maybe 10 years. We'll think about something, but just save face for both sides and resolve the issue. Now, I think the Pakistanis have been trying very hard. I can understand the Indian objection. I think the Indians were probably nervous also about dealing with a military ruler or signing a deal with a military ruler. They would have preferred to sign a deal on Kashmir with a civilian government. But I think the real issue here is that, you know, and for American strategy to work on Pakistan, you have to push the Indians towards doing more on Kashmir. That was my point. You cannot expect the insecurities of the Pakistan army to disappear just because you say so. You have to work towards making them disappear. And that means, you know, bringing India on board and getting India to help and getting perhaps faster movement on Kashmir. I think this is a personal feeling. I'm not, you know, in answer to your question, I really think that the army is willing to pull back from the tribal areas, surrender sovereignty, you're absolutely right, surrender sovereignty to the Pakistani Taliban. Because at the first instance, it feels that it wants to, it's being done at the expense of maintaining the Afghan Taliban leadership. Now, this is a critical year. Everybody knows that by March next year, you may get Obama in the White House. You will get probably much more attention for Pakistan and Afghanistan and a much tougher democratic administration towards sanctuaries, towards all these issues. And I think that's why this year is absolutely critical. It's critical for the Afghan Taliban. It's critical for the Pakistani Taliban to create as much mayhem and havoc and to strengthen their position as much as possible. And unfortunately, I feel that at one level, the Pakistan military is willing to surrender sovereignty for a time in the tribal areas in order to back the Afghan Taliban. And that is what this agreement is spelling out in reality. Because these agreements are saying, you know, don't fight us, go fight the Americans in Afghanistan. Go fight NATO. And that's why it is hugely detrimental to the whole international system. And I think, you know, that's why these sanctuaries have to come to an end very, very soon. Otherwise, you know, another year of this, say until, you know, the next U.S. president comes in by March or April next year, whenever, you know, another year of this is really going to wreak mayhem in the region. Not to speak of what's happening in Central Asia with the groups, you know, who are active in Fatah, like the IMU and the Islamic Jihad and other groups such as, we don't know what they're up to in Central Asia.
You want to mine the rich vein in the middle here that haven't gotten to yet? Let's start with this woman in the back there. Yeah.
My name is Laura Keith. I'm also from George Washington University, actually in the Homeland Security Policy Institute. Thank you for coming today, Mr. Rashid. My question is really in regards to your comments on a overarching regional strategy for the region. Can you elaborate what you mean by that, what you envision? Does it entail U.S. leadership? And can you also talk about what you mean by when you said we should see the region in a more positive light?
I think there was another in that row there, yeah.
My name is Yoav Khani. I'm a journalist, a former USIP senior fellow. I would like to take Mr. Rashid back to what has been referred to as the original sin, that is the reliance on, indeed, the employment of warlords in Afghanistan. And perhaps in light of what the United States ended up doing in Iraq, balking in 2003, the idea of relying on local Sunni sheikh to quell the insurgency in Iraq, yet adopted it wholeheartedly 4 years later, this having become a part and parcel of a winning strategy in Iraq. As for Afghanistan, had any attempt at successfully centralizing the governance of Afghanistan worked in the past, with the notable and unfortunate exception of the Taliban? It didn't work under the monarchy. It didn't work under the short-lived Daoud Republic in the 1970s. It didn't work under the Soviets and their allies. It didn't work under the Mujahideen. Was there any alternative, really, to the reliance on the warlords back in 2001?
Great question. And the woman in the front here.
Hamaidan Asidi from the World Bank. I have two very quick questions. Number one, what do you think the prospects are for the elections in Afghanistan in 2009? Number two, what do you think can be done to improve governance and transparency that are resulting in the lack of development, effectiveness, and reconstruction in Afghanistan? Thank you.
Well, you know, I think I've answered this. Perhaps, you know, I'm not phrasing this right. When I say regional strategy, I mean interlocking the problems of the region as a whole, meaning that you cannot deal with one country on a separate basis. You know, in order to get Pakistan to move away from supporting sanctuaries, you have to reassure it about India. And in order to reassure it about India, you have to push the Indians to, you know, resolve Kashmir. So, I mean, and the same goes right across the region. I mean, Afghanistan and Iran, Afghanistan and Pakistan. For example, the Durand Line issue between the two countries really needs to be addressed very seriously by the Afghans, you know, and by the Pakistanis. I don't think you can have a resolution, a long-term resolution about ending these sanctuaries without actually the Afghans recognizing the Durand Line. So what I'm talking about is a strategy which recognizes that you have to work, you know, you have to work at several levels and at several countries at the same time to resolve one problem. That's, I think, you know, that's what I mean.
I think the U.S. But the U.S. role question, should the U.S. be...
Yeah, I mean, the U.S. has to have
this strategy.
Here.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, that's what I'm saying.
It's only
I mean, the U.S. has to have this strategy.
Okay.
You know, the U.S. has to adopt a more regional outlook on the... look, I mean, to cut a long answer short, perhaps during the war, there was the need to depend on warlords. What I question in this book is the empowerment of warlords after the war. I mean, that's what that was the real sin. Now, I don't think anybody particularly wanted 100,000 American troops invading Afghanistan and defeating Afghanistan. Although, of course, the issue was that the Americans never had enough troops in Afghanistan, and they should have had far more than they did. But the warlords were used to defeat the Taliban, or, you know, the Northern Alliance warlords. The question was afterwards, they were put on the payroll and empowered in unimaginable ways which nobody had conceived of before. And this was very much the actions and the thinking of particularly Paul Wolfowitz at the Defense Department. And in fact, in one meeting with him, I called him Warlord Wolfowitz, you know, because he was just, he thought this was a great policy. And this needed to be spread to Iraq and to, you know, all over the world, Somalia and Sudan, and, you know, you empower local warlords. And, I mean, you know, there was no way, and it was, you know, this was, I think, you know, this was reflective of the attitude that there was this kind of, you know, somebody had planted this idea, but there was no information or, you know, reality-based information that, do you know the history of the warlords in Afghanistan? Do you know how they've oppressed the people, how they're hated by the people? That this is a 20-year phenomenon, you know, and you're reimposing this whole thing, the whole structure back again, when people expected to be freed and kind of liberated. So I think the real problem there was this empowerment, you know, after the war. Your question, of course, is very interesting about the elections. We haven't talked about that. In Kabul, I was in Kabul last week, 2 weeks ago, and the elections is what everybody is discussing. Karzai is certainly going to stand. I have several fears about the elections. The first is that Karzai is far more unpopular now than he was before. His credibility has been shot through. There does not seem to be, on his side, the attempt to constitute a political party or an agenda which would really, in other words, fight an election campaign. I fear very much that it will be based on the same premise as it was in his first presidential election campaign, which would be a lot of tribal politics rather than the modern politics of political parties, which is what I think the country needs very badly. Secondly, of course, there's enormous speculation as to who all are going to stand against him. Is there going to be a coalition which can bridge the ethnic divide between the Tajiks and the Pashtuns so that you actually put up a credible opposition figure who will bridge, who will be able to rally both a Pashtun vote bank as well as the Northern Alliance vote bank, or you know, the non-Pashtun vote bank. There's a lot of speculation as to who those figures might be, which I'd be happy to share with you afterwards. And there's also speculation that there would be several Pashtuns standing who would cut into Karzai's vote bank. And I think there are two very big fears which are being expressed by the international community, by the UN and by other people. The first fear is that, of course, you may not be able to have an election because the South is, you know, in insurgency. The second big fear is that if the government is seen to be losing, the people around Karzai may decide to rig the elections, in which case you would have a real breakdown, political breakdown. The third fear is that if it's a close election, which would be expected, especially if Pashtuns, you know, if three Pashtuns stand, they would each take 3% of the vote, they would cut into his Pashtun vote bank. The danger is that then you would have to go into a second round. You would have to go into a second round. And that would not be possible, simply because there would be such a uproar about rigging, about, you know, corruption, about vote buying, about, and that it would really put the whole country at risk. So, in fact, this election is going to be an extremely difficult thing to do. To go into a second round, to prevent rigging, whether you can stabilize the South sufficiently, how are you going to register the voters? You know, that's one of the big issues that the government and the UN face right now with this insurgency in the South. Anyway, thank you.
And we'll take last two questions. This gentleman over here has been patiently waiting.
I haven't answered your other questions.
Thank you very much. I'm Ian Bond from the British Embassy. I wanted to start by putting the record straight on our attitude to talks in the Fatah particularly. David Miliband made very clear at the time that while certainly we see talking to people who can be reconciled as a necessary part of counterinsurgency, that doesn't mean giving people a blank check. And I think we and the Americans have been in exactly the same place on the need not to allow cross-border activity into Afghanistan or activity against our interests elsewhere in the world. The question that I had related to the fragility of the coalition government in Pakistan, and I wondered whether you could say anything about how the political parties might develop into something more than the regional or almost family-based operations that they are at the moment. You talked in the Afghan context about moving from tribal politics to modern party politics. You might say that something similar could be needed in the Pakistani system, and I wonder whether you see how that might develop.
There's one more person just behind him, I think. Yeah.
What is the first question? Back.
My name is Colin Cookman from the Center for American Progress. Recognizing the flawed nature of some of the actors in Pakistani politics today and the very fragile situation there currently with the coalition government, I was wondering if you could offer any specific course of action you think the United States could take to strengthen civilian control over foreign policymaking and security policymaking in Pakistan? Is it just a matter of withdrawing aid money being sent to the military? Are there other steps you think could be taken? Thank you.
I think that's it. You've got the last...
What is the first question? I forgot. Lack of something I've written here.
The British Embassy question?
The British was the first, right?
Yeah, yes.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, I mean, I agree with you completely. I think every Pakistani would like to see modern party politics, political leaders elected in their own party, not because of blood and family fiefdom, but because of, you know, competence and authority and respect, etc., like that. Yeah, I mean, you know, I think you're absolutely right. But at the same time, I think we have to recognize, you know, where society is. Society remains, you know, politics in Pakistan remains dynastic, unfortunately, whether you're talking of the left or the right. Even the Islamic fundamentalist parties like Jamaat-e-Islami, I mean, the leaders of the Jamaat have a stranglehold. There's a family stranglehold almost on the leadership of the Jamaat. So nobody's immune from this. And, you know, maybe this is a South Asia phenomenon. I mean, India is a hugely developed democracy, but suffers from exactly the same problems, or at least the Congress Party does. So I think we'll have to live with this for some time to come. But I think Afghanistan has a real chance of making a break with this. I hope we are able to do so in Pakistan. It's terribly important. But it's not going to happen in a hurry, I think. And, you know, the Pakistan People's Party will be looking for its next Bhutto, whether it's the son or the daughter or some niece or something like that, for quite some time to come yet. Well, you know, what the U.S. can do to I think it's to strengthen the civilian government, basically, to really help empower the civilian government, which first of all needs a lot of economic aid. And I think what the U.S. could do would be to rally the international community around providing some kind of economic relief to the civilian government, and then really dealing with issues that, you know, the bulk of the population is concerned with. I mean, I think, you know, in these last 10 years, you know, what people say is, have we seen, you know, are there big landmark American hospitals being built, or American universities, or American roads, or American, you know, power stations, or anything else? No, because, you know, so much of the aid has just gone straight into the coffers of the military. And I think the whole program of U.S. aid has to be reorientated. Towards a much more people approach. I mean, if you're what limited aid is going to Afghanistan, you're doing it in Afghanistan. I think, you know, you ought to be able to doing it in Pakistan also. So I think, you know, there's a great deal the U.S. can do to strengthen the civilian government. For a start, it would help a great deal if President Bush would stop saying every 4 days how valuable Musharraf is to the United States. I think that would be a great help. Unfortunately, there hasn't, you know, he did it only 4 days ago, once again. I mean, you know, just as reports were coming in that Musharraf might be resigning, you know, Bush says, please don't resign, please stay on, you know. So I think that would be of great help to the political process.
Before thanking our speaker, I'd like to invite you all. Next Friday at 2, we have Patrick Coburn coming to talk about al-Sadr. He's just done a rather well-reviewed biography of that religious, political, military leader of Iraq. And so I hope you'll join us for that, and I know there are a number of other programs. But please join me in thanking USIP for making this event possible, and Alex for your gracious co-hosting of this event. And our speaker as well, Ahmed Rashid, for his... Thank you.